books that are seen as contravening a very traditional, rigid conception of what family life ought to look like in America, and then books that are construed as sexually provocative. They're being labeled pornography, even though they don't bear any resemblance to the legal definition of pornography. So it's a painting with a very broad brush, and most of these objections have been brought by a single teacher in the school district. This is not a groundswell of parents who are raising these objections. It's a single individual, and on the basis of that, in many cases, as we outline in our complaint, the school board has overridden the considered opinion of its own review panel. So it has an empowered review panel of experts that it has designated to read books when there is an objection, to take a look and decide whether there is value for children, whether these books ought to remain in the classroom. And the pattern in Escambia that's so disturbing is a political override of that expert opinion. So their own designated panel is being brushed to the side, and politics and ideology are ruling the day.
And it's interesting that you did this with Penguin Random House, a publisher. With the major textbook publishers, when they are told to take out certain things or their books will not be bought in a certain state, it's not like they produce books for every state. So when one state does this, it changes the reading material all over the country, right? It's not also just that Ron DeSantis is going to announce for president of the United States and so have that national impact. But it's that the publishers have to go with the lowest common denominator so they don't have to selectively publish books in each state.
Well, that's right, and it's a real concern. States like Florida and Texas are large. They have huge school systems. They have market power. And so when they start to dictate what ideas need to be taken out of a history textbook, what episodes can be talked about? Can you talk about Black Lives Matter? Can you talk about the Black Panther movement? If they say no, that has repercussions. I think that's one of the reasons why we really all need to be concerned about this, whether you're on the left or the right. These are fundamental free speech issues. They're ideologically motivated, state-sponsored bans and prohibition on speech, kind of exactly striking to the heart of what the First Amendment gets at. And we all have a stake in it because, as you say, a ban in Florida can affect students all over the country when textbook manufacturers and book publishers become cautious. They start to worry. Who's going to object? Are these books going to be accepted? Are they going to get bought? Maybe we ought to be more cautious and circumspect about what we include here. And that, you know, for an educational system that is supposed to prepare kids for a diverse society, a complex society, to be able to grapple with all sorts of ideas, narratives, and people, we're really doing them a disservice.
I want to bring Kelly Carter Jackson into this conversation, professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College, author of the award-winning book Force and Freedom, Black Abolitionists and the Politics of Violence. Your recent piece for CNN is titled Why Historians Like Me Are Taking on Ron DeSantis. She's just returned from St. Petersburg, Florida, where she participated in a 24-hour teach-in with other historians. Can you talk about why you went to Florida for this teach-in? And what is happening to Black history, not only in Florida right now, but how it's being taught or not taught around the country?
Sure. I was happy to respond to the call when Dr. Terry Scott and Yehuru Williams organized this event through the Institute of Common Power, and they said, we're doing a 24-hour teach-in. We want scholars and teachers and educators from all over the country to come to Florida to let people know that the stakes are high, that this matters, that all of our livelihoods are at risk when we think about the erasure and the marginalization that comes along with a lot of Ron DeSantis' policies. So as a historian, I know how much history matters. I know that the world that we live in today is shaped by the past, shaped by policy of the past, shaped by decisions people have made. And so it was really important for me to come and to teach. I taught at 11 p.m. at night. It went literally for 24 hours. There were people teaching at 2 a.m. and 4 a.m. And I took a course that I normally teach in about 12 weeks and shrunk it down to about 45 minutes and just talked about why Black history matters. And I went from the great Western kingdoms of Mali and Ghana and Sangaye all the way up into the present and just talked about how meaningful African-American contributions are, that we can't discuss major events, major turning points, without talking about Black people, without talking about women, without talking about LGBTQ people. So it was so important to be there, and I'm glad that we did it. I really wanted people to get mobilized, to get educated first, but then take that education and let it empower them to really respond and react to what DeSantis is doing.
Let me ask you about Black history classes, AP courses, and what's happened there, how they have been changed, and how the College Board has been working with, though they originally denied it, going back and forth with the Florida Department of Education to make their AP course acceptable to to Governor DeSantis's Department of Education.
You know, it's a real battle because oftentimes African-American history is taught like an elective. It's not taught as a core requirement. So when people see Black history, when they see, you know, ethnic history as something that's tangential, as something that's maybe superficial, they don't see it as a requirement for going to college. They don't see it as a requirement as part of their K through 12 education. And so when the College Board put together this African-American history course, they called on scholars from all over the country and said, help us shape this curriculum. Help us show why it has value and meaning and what it can add to the students who take this course, what it can add to their intellectual and emotional learning. And so I was a part of that task force. A lot of other scholars were as well. And it was really disheartening to see how censored and chipped away the curriculum was. There were things like intersectionality that were not being able to be discussed, the idea of multiple oppressions and multiple intersections of one's identity. There were things about Black Lives Matter that were completely taken off the textbooks as well. And certain scholars and activists who were being marginalized or erased from the curriculum too. And this is a problem for us because you can't teach Black history without teaching these concepts, without talking about people like James Baldwin or Toni Morrison or Audre Lorde, or Kimberly Crenshaw for that matter. And so these things are still at play. We're still pushing to make sure that the curriculum is being taught. But these laws require a certain kind of savviness in order to get around some of these restrictions.
And your response to Governor DeSantis, who's supposedly announcing for president this week, saying that Florida is where woke goes to die?
Yeah, this is a real problem for me. I think that, you know, I live in Massachusetts, and I think people look at Florida and they're like, what are they doing there? This is crazy. But I'm concerned. I'm concerned that DeSantis will become, you know, the proverbial Simon Says, that instead of creating these, you know, wild and outrageous policy infrastructures in Florida, that he will take this to the entire country and that all of the country will look like Florida. And for me, that's really disturbing because it disempowers people. It makes people afraid of things that they ought not to be afraid of. I think that DeSantis is doing a lot of fear-mongering, and he's stirring up strife in people where I think there is not a lot of division. I think all people want their children to be educated, to have access to books to read, to be able to learn as much as they possibly can. All parents should want their children to be critical thinkers. And I think that DeSantis is really trying to push back hard against that. And I think it's going to have a backlash. I really think at the national level, it is going to backfire.
And your response to Governor DeSantis's bill that prohibits public schools and private businesses from making people feel discomfort and guilt as we talk about the erasing of Black Lives Matter movement or even issues of slavery and reparations?
Even that is sort of absurd to me, because when I teach this history in my classrooms, certainly students feel a certain level of empathy, as they should when we talk about things like slavery and segregation. But most importantly, I want them to understand the causes of this, the consequences of this, how we work to not repeat this anymore. I also think that if I'm talking about my own Black children, I would also want them to be taught in a way that does not make them feel small, that does not make them feel like their identity as an African-American child does not matter. So we have to find a ways to be more inclusive, not less inclusive, and talking about these histories that matter to all of us and that make America what America is.
Professor Kelly Carter-Jackson, you teach Africana Studies at Wellesley College. You're featured in the new Netflix documentary series called African Queens, Nijinga, executive produced and narrated by Jada Pinkett Smith. This is the trailer.
Born into an era of darkness, a warrior, a queen destined to lead.
There are no slaves in my kingdom.
She fearlessly defended her kingdom against European power.
The king's under threat.
The king is always under threat.
Slavery threatened to decimate a continent.
We are people born running from extinction.
Rising to become a beacon of light for her people.
I have nothing to lose, which makes me dangerous.
What do you want?
The kind of power that will make a difference in my people's lives. Let's leave these new foreigners in no doubt who I am.
Such a power move. It's such a boss move.
Nijinga was a mother of a nation, but she loved her country. And for that, she made great sacrifices.
Nijinga was the only African leader to be recognized by European rulers in power as a female king.
I think of her as probably one of the greatest women warriors and women leaders this world has ever seen.
All hail Queen Jinga!
The trailer for the Netflix documentary series African Queens, Nijinga, executive produced and narrated by Jada Pinkett Smith. I spent last night watching this series, basically watching you, Professor Kelly Carter-Jackson. It's an epic series, taking on everyone from Portugal to the Catholic Church. Talk about its significance and the concern that maybe children in this country would not be allowed to see it.
Oh, man. First of all, I was so honored to be a part of that documentary. It really is wonderful, and I think it introduces Queen Nijinga to the world. I think not a lot of people are familiar with African history, let alone specific kingdoms and rulers, and to know that Queen Nijinga was a warrior king, that she was fighting off the Portuguese, that she was trying to protect her people from the institution of slavery, that she was doing this as a young woman, but even until her 60s and 70s, she's riding out onto horseback, you know, like fighting against the Portuguese. It is an epic story of her life and such a major contribution to understanding slavery and the slave trade and the Atlantic world. I realized that, you know, if students can't get this in Florida in their classrooms, that Netflix is something that's readily available to a lot of people. And I hope that people will sit down and they will watch this and they will grapple with this history and they will want to learn more about African history because it's so important. It is not tangential, it's not superficial, that you have real people that are making incredible contributions to how we think about our own freedom and our own identity. And Queen Nijinga does that. And the fact that she's a woman and a Black woman and, you know, is so courageous, the story really is inspiring. It's definitely violent. It's definitely not for children, I would say. But, you know, if you have teenagers, if you have older children that you can, you know, really talk them through this, I think it's a wonderful way of looking at this history and making sense of it.
Well, congratulations on this series. And finally, I wanted to go to a very different topic with Suzanne Nossel. I wanted to ask you about the Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen, who resigned from your board, from the board of PEN America, after PEN America canceled a Russian writers panel at your World Voices Festival after Ukrainian writers threatened to boycott. I know this was a very difficult issue. Can you explain the decision?
I need to correct you, Amy. So what happened was we have this annual World Voices Festival. We had two separate panels, one of Ukrainian soldiers coming from the front who were putting together with American soldiers who are also authors. And so that was one panel. And then we had a separate panel with Russian writers, including Masha, and two other Russian journalists, and one historian, one journalist, who we've actually brought here to New York to work on a project that was initiated by Masha and PEN America called the Russian Internet Archive, that archives independent media from Russia that was at risk of being destroyed once Putin cracked down on independent media so aggressively after the Ukraine war started. So we had these two separate panels. The Ukrainians had told us they couldn't be on stage in an event with Russians. Once they arrived here after the long trip from Ukraine, they made clear that they were not willing or able to be in an entire festival with Russians, even though it was a separate event, separate venue, that just the very fact that they were in the same festival posed a real problem for them. And it wasn't just an ethical objection, but rather a concern in terms of the visas that they had gotten that enabled them to get permission from the army to take leave and come here to the U.S. to bring their stories. So then we had a real dilemma about what to do with these two events that we very much wanted to host. And we proposed to both sides, could we go forward but rebrand the event, just call it PEN America instead of PEN World Voices, same venue, same participants, same time of day. That was our proposal, one approach that we took to trying to resolve it. The Ukrainians felt that would run counter to the permission they had gotten to leave to be part of this big festival. I think the Russians felt, and Masha felt, that it, they put it in an article in The Atlantic, that it was sort of being at a lesser table, and that felt uncomfortable. And so they actually made the decision to cancel. And they put it, I think, poignantly, saying, look, it's difficult to discuss writing in exile, which is the topic of a panel, under the best of circumstances. And these were not the best of circumstances. So, you know, with regret, we accepted that decision. And that's where things netted out. And, you know, it's unfortunate. Masha was a valued trustee of PEN America for more than 9 years. We are grateful that Masha has indicated they will remain a PEN member and remain involved in this Russian independent media archive project, which is so important.
Yes, as the award-winning writer Masha Gessen told The Atlantic Monthly, I felt like I was being asked to tell these people that because they're Russians, they can't sit at the big table. They have to sit at the little table off to the side. Suzanne Nossel, I want to thank you so much for being with us, CEO of PEN America, and Kelly Carter Jackson, professor, historian, author, professor at Wellesley College. Next up, we go to Ecuador, where President Guillermo Lasso has dissolved parliament in order to avoid being impeached. Stay with us.
Why are there so many songs about rainbows? And what's on the other side? Rainbows are visions, but only illusions, and rainbows have nothing to hide. So we've been told, and some choose to believe it. I know they're wrong, wait and see. Someday we'll find it, the rainbow connection, the lovers, the dreamers.
The Rainbow Connection by Kermit the Frog. opponents of Nebraska's 12-week abortion ban and ban on gender-affirming surgery for minors sang the song together in Nebraska's Capitol Rotunda. The bill passed Friday afternoon. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show in Ecuador, where the conservative president, Guillermo Lasso, has dissolved the opposition-led National Assembly. The move was seen as an effort to block efforts to impeach him and came as the body held its first hearing into corruption embezzlement allegations against Lasso. He used a constitutional power that's never been used in Ecuador before. It allows him to rule by decree until new elections are held, likely in August. He told The Washington Post he doesn't plan to run for president again. Lasso is a millionaire conservative banker elected in 2021. He was set to serve his term until 2025 and visited the White House in December. Even after the corruption allegations surfaced, Republican Senator Marco Rubio flew to Ecuador in late February to show his support for Lasso. This comes as Ecuador has faced increasing poverty and violence has soared, promoting more Ecuadorians to seek a better life in the United States. For more, we're joined in Guayaquil, Ecuador, by Andres Arauz, the Ecuadorian politician and economist. He ran for president in 2021 in a contested election against Lasso. Arauz served as director of Ecuador's central bank and then minister of knowledge and human talent under the administration of the former president, Rafael Correa. He's also a senior research fellow at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Andres Arauz. Can you talk about what's happened, the significance of Lasso dissolving the parliament?
Thank you, Amy, for the invitation. Yes, Lasso's dissolution of parliament is the first in our history. And unfortunately, it was a cowardly measure taken days before the impeachment process ended, and which would have resulted in his destitution, so him sacking of power. So it was a cowardly measure that, despite being that, now opens the opportunity for Ecuadorian citizens to go to the booths and to decide on the future democratically. So we see that part of the decision as a hopeful part that, you know, of course, is going to give us a chance to participate in the elections and hopefully allow progressive forces to regroup and, you know, in a pretty quick turnaround of time, have the opportunity to, you know, have an enlightened position and get together a broad coalition just enough to win. However, this dissolution of parliament also brings about risks because Lasso's measure allows him to rule by decree, to issue laws by decree with a filter from the Constitutional Court. Lasso has already mentioned that he plans to use this power to roll back labor laws, to privatize the key state-owned assets like oil industry, electricity, utility systems, telecommunications, strategic sectors such as those. And it also has a promise to issue a decree which creates or converts Ecuador into what's called a tax haven, right? A financial sector free zone is what he has called it.
Can you talk about Lasso immediately deploying police forces to the streets, while Ecuador's chief of the Joint Command of the Armed Forces told Ecuadorian citizens Lasso's decision was constitutional, should be respected? He threatened those planning protests, saying this country will not accept any attempt to disrupt the constitutional order and democracy through violence.
Yeah, well, Lasso, even before the decree was issued and published in the official gazette, Lasso sent the military to parliament and prevented anybody from getting into parliament, literally cut all cables that joined parliament with the rest of society. There is no electricity in parliament, no phone connections, no internet connections, no fiber optic whatsoever. And Lasso fired everybody within the parliament, even, you know, janitors and employees that would have to, you know, keep and give maintenance to the institution. And, of course, he did that with the support and full support of the military. He ordered the military. I'm not talking about the Minister of Defense. I'm talking about the actual military commanders to issue a statement together saying that the decree was constitutional even before the Constitutional Court had the chance to say that that was so. So, of course, it's called a fait accompli, right? Once he uses the military, you could expect very little difference from the actual courts. So, unfortunately, that was an authoritarian measure taken by Lasso. And now the democracy is also at risk because, together with the military, on the same day of the dissolution of parliament, he used the prosecutor general to sack 3 out of the 5 members of the Judicial Administrative Council and started actions to also remove from their positions the Citizens Participation Council, which in Ecuador has a very important role, which is designate the authorities for the Electoral Commission. So we are a bit scared in Ecuador that Lasso might use this the force and the prosecutor general to remove opposition politicians from power and from key posts.
So can you address two things? Many human rights activists are deeply concerned that this power to govern by decree could open the door for even more human rights violations. For example, using terrorism laws to target indigenous groups that might oppose him. And what do you anticipate will happen in the next 90 days before the snap elections that now apparently Lasso says he will not run for president in? Are you planning to run for president in these August elections? And how are people preparing for this?
Well, these snap elections definitely take everyone by surprise. Political parties are trying to quickly organize themselves into coalitions. What I have said is that more important than my name or than anybody's name, we need to make sure we have a broad coalition. In 2021, we lost because we weren't able to attract, you know, around 20-30% of the populations in the Ecuadorian highlands that voted a null vote, so they spoiled their vote. We need that to actually become a proactive vote in favor of democracy, in favor of opportunities, in favor of progressive agenda, and that's what I'm focusing my energies on now. Obviously, derived from that process, there's political leadership that's being built, and we'll see whether that coalition decides on my name as a possibility. However, I'm willing to support anyone that comes out of that historic process. There are threats, and we're not so sure that this will be a swift electoral process. We see that Lasso has leaned on the military, on the judicial, to try to pressure different authorities. And we see a lot of negative signs with respect to the possibility of perhaps putting a lot of, Lasso dragging his feet with regards to the budget for the electoral process, for example, and stuff like that that may complicate the electoral process.
I mentioned that Senator Rubio was supporting Lasso. Also, the Biden administration has supported him despite the accusations of corruption. Lasso is very wealthy, much of that wealth stored in U.S. trusts, LLCs. Is that correct? How does this work? And what are you calling on the Biden administration, how to recognize this president who has dissolved the National Assembly?
Well, we see that the U.S. has given a lot of support to Lasso, the person, not Ecuador, the country, not the Ecuadorian people. During Lasso's government, for example, most of the vaccines that were provided to Ecuadorian population actually came from China. Lasso asked the U.S. to sign a free trade agreement, and that didn't happen. He actually signed a free trade agreement with China. So what we see is a U.S. policy directed only basically on the security sphere by sending plenty of intelligence officials and equipment now operating even from the Galapagos Islands, while the Ecuadorian people have not received any benefits in terms of the treatment of Ecuadorian migrants in the U.S. or Fulbright scholarships or better trade opportunities and so on. And unfortunately, what we see is the part of the Biden administration, especially certain high-ranking senators in the U.S., supporting Lasso personally. Lasso has immense wealth of probably $500 million now in the U.S., stashed in trusts in South Dakota, also in real estate and shady properties in South Florida, a certain LLC structure that, you know, doesn't is not very transparent. but which is, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars worth. And we now see that these properties that he owns, even, you know, he owns an offshore bank in Panama as well, are in violation of Ecuadorian's law that prohibits government officials from having property in tax havens.
We have to leave it there. Andres Arauz, Ecuadorian politician and economist, and we'll post a Spanish interview at democracynow.org as well. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week, I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.